Voting in Florida, it should be free, but for some, it's just too expensive to cast a ballot. Good morning and live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening today. Just ahead this morning, we've got a closer look at the fines and fees returning citizens are being asked to pay before they can vote. What do you think about this? It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Then later, a preview of this year's TEDx Jacksonville. But first this hour, Florida voters passed Amendment 4 last year, thinking it would automatically restore voting rights for more than a million people in this state who had a previous felony conviction. But then the state legislature and the governor passed a measure that requires all those people to pay fines and fees before they can cast a ballot. And a new investigation shows the costs are sometimes so exorbitant that voting is still out of reach for many. Freelance journalist Claire Goforth investigated the issue in her new piece, Florida: Fees, Fines from Felonies Means Disenfranchised. This appears in the Juvenile Justice Information Exchange. She joins us now in studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Thanks for being with us. So what prompted this investigation?
Well, you know, I had the contract with the Juvenile Justice Information Exchange to report on criminal justice issues in the state of Florida. It was a topic that I was particularly interested in, having covered the disenfranchisement of people with felony convictions in the past. When Amendment 4 passed, I, like many, believed that those 1.4 million people, which was the estimated number, would get the right to vote back, and that would be that. But then when the legislature implemented Senate Bill 7066, it took away the vote for many people. At first, we really didn't know how many. It wasn't until the University of Florida political science professor Daniel Smith did some analysis of this and found that as many as 80% of that 1.4 million lost their vote because of Senate Bill 7066. And on top of that, not only have these people lost their right to vote, but the fines and fees and restitution, which you also have to pay before you can vote, that Florida charges, particularly in fines and fees, it's an insane schedule. The numbers are incredibly high. There's no method to the madness. Charges like trafficking of marijuana will net you a $250,000 fine. Meanwhile, sexual assault, forcible violent sexual assault, will net you a discretionary $10,000 fine. That doesn't make sense to a lot of people.
It's 549-2937 to join us. You found a local Jacksonville woman you profile in the story who's barred from voting. Tell us about her.
Yeah, Rosemary McCoy. She's 61 years old, and she got a few felony convictions in 2015. And she actually was one of the people who collected signatures for Amendment 4. She ultimately registered to vote and did vote prior to the passage of Senate Bill 7066. Rosemary McCoy is a woman whose mother fought for civil rights. Her mother had passed away last year at the age of 103. And for her to have suddenly lost her right to vote and be in a position where, with the $7,000 worth of restitution that she currently owes, working part-time, collecting ballot signatures for another initiative, it's just not enough money for her to pay it. So here she is, a woman who takes a lot of pride in civic engagement and finds and feels very strongly about the importance of voting, who cannot vote. And it was heartbreaking, quite frankly, to watch her weep as she talked about how she feels like she's facing the same struggle that her mother faced all those years ago.
Do we know how many Florida citizens who cannot afford to pay these fines and fees will be barred from voting, particularly next year in the presidential election?
It could be as many as 1.1 million, according to the data that the professor from the University of Florida came up with for the ACLU, which is pretty shocking. I mean, when Senate Bill 7066 passed, it was on strict party lines. And as we well know, it was under Governor Rick Scott that people getting their voting rights back, really, there was such a small number of them that was the impetus for people to get Amendment 4 on the ballot. And now, again, you know, another Republican-led initiative and a Republican governor have then taken away that right to vote for so many people.
Critics of the governor's move and the legislature's moves on this say that it's a deliberate attempt to disenfranchise Black voters who they perceive to be predisposed to vote for Democrats. The governor and the legislature have denied that.
They have. And there definitely is a racially disproportionate impact on Black voters, because Black people are statistically more likely to be arrested and convicted. Florida's population is 17% African American, and roughly half of our prison population is African American. Now, what the governor and the legislature say is that the advocates for Amendment 4, when they were talking about it with the Florida Supreme Court to get it on the ballot, they conceded that they viewed the sentence to include payment of fees, fines, and restitution. That therein lies their argument. But even regardless of that, do we think that it is just that people who have done their time in prison, they have completed the terms of their probation and parole, if they are one of the very, very few that still are getting parole in Florida, that they can no longer express their civil rights as a voter for potentially the rest of their lives?
We'll go to your calls in a moment as we discuss a new investigation looking into the way fines and fees being levied against those with a prior felony conviction are preventing them from voting. This could be up to 1 million Floridians, despite you, the voters, overwhelmingly approving Amendment 4 last year that automatically restored voting rights for Florida residents who have a previous felony conviction, 1.4 million of them. What do you think about this? It's 549-2937. And so for all of the voters out there who checked yes to approve Amendment 4, there's frustration, Claire, because they interpreted the amendment to be automatic. And certainly the people that got it on the ballot intended it to be self-executing.
They certainly did. There's a very strong argument that the legislature did not need to act. They did not need to implement the amendment in order for it to be effective. But they chose to do so, thus taking away the right to vote for so many people. And I think what a lot of us were caught off guard by was how many people owe these fees and fines and restitution. And the sheer number of the amount of money that they are being ordered to pay at the time when they're sentenced. I was caught off guard. I'm an attorney and I have practiced criminal law, and I had no idea the scope of these fees and fines in Florida. I mean, when the Florida court system is ordering roughly $1 billion of fees and fines and collecting it off poor people and minorities in order to fund the courts and also to fund roughly $300 million of other programs, many of which don't have a lot to do with criminal justice. State Senator Jeff Brandis told me that it's basically just used as a budgetary hole plugger. You raise some fines and fees, and then you get the money that you need.
How much money are these fines and fees raising, and where all is it going? You looked into that as well.
I did, yes. And about $600 million of the $900 million that was collected last year is actually funding the court system on what's called cash register justice. But the other $300 million goes to all these random trust funds and programs. And, you know, many of them are very worthy programs, but some of it doesn't make sense. For instance, if you get a boating under the influence conviction, there's a fee that goes to some spinal cord rehabilitation fund. And it's really hard to see the logical connection for that between those two things. And, you know, a lot of this debt, particularly if you're looking at juveniles or people with certain drug convictions that carry very high fines, that debt is seen as uncollectible. So what is the point of it?
You also researched the history of this. This began in the 1980s when the drug war really was at its height. And then in the 90s, the state hit upon this idea of funding the court system through people who've broken the law. Can you explain that?
Right. So the drug war created a very large burden on the court system. With the increasing cost, and as the state was simultaneously becoming ever more tax averse, they had to come up with a source of the funds. So in the 90s, they decided, well, why don't we just pay for the court system through the people that use it? So in 1998, Florida passed an amendment, I guess it was a constitutional amendment, that required the court system to be entirely self-funded through people who use it. In 2004, it went into effect. Since then, the state has added so many fines and fees. Today, there's more than 100 categories of offenses that carry some significant fines, most of them mandatory. And then when you look at the fees, you know, a simple $1,000 fee for a misdemeanor traffic violation, it's, you know, $1,000. And then if you add up, I was actually stunned when I added up how all these like nickel and dime sort of fees that go along with it, it came out to $1,300, more than 30% more than the original fine. And some of these are as low as a dollar. There's even there's a fee that's 15 cents for juvenile cases. It's just, it's incredibly complicated and hard to understand. And then what's more, I mean, you look at some of this stuff and you say, why are we charging a person who steals a single fish from an aquaculture facility $10,000 in a fine? If you steal a single fish, I don't think you have $10, much let alone $10,000.
Let's go to your calls now as we speak with journalist Claire Goforth. Her new investigation looking into fines and fees preventing could be up to 1 million Floridians from voting in the next election, despite the passage of Amendment 4, which was supposed to automatically restore their rights. In a moment, we'll look at the next steps for this and efforts to pay those folks fines and fees. That's part of this investigation as well. Other people stepping in to try to pay the fines and fees for those who've been disenfranchised. But where do you stand on this? What do you think? 549-2937. Susan is in Mandarin. Hi, Susan. Good morning.
I was also outraged about all the fees once Amendment 4 passed. I was wondering if you could talk about recidivism and how these massive fines might hurt people that are trying to become full citizens. Another thing that SB 7066 did was make people confess to their felony conviction on the voter registration form. I called the supervisor of elections, and he is still accepting the forms that were valid the day that Amendment 4 became effective, which I think was January 8th. So if somebody completes the old form, they don't have to confess that they're a felon, which I think is better. I don't think you should have to confess that on your voter registration form. But what I was wondering also is if you completed the form before they passed SB 7066, and as far as you knew, your voting rights had been restored, and then it was taken away when 7066 was passed. So can they still vote? Thank you.
Thank you, Susan.
Yeah, excellent question, Susan. So you cannot vote just by, even if you have no intent to vote without having paid your fees, fines, and restitution, it's still going to be a crime if you do so. As far as I know, no one has thus far been charged with this, but the fact remains that people who have no idea they may owe a fee or a fine that do register to vote and vote, it is possible they could get charged again.
In other states, that has happened. Egregious case in particular, I can't remember which state, Claire, but a woman went and voted thinking she had her rights restored. She hadn't, and she actually was put in jail.
Yeah, that could happen. And for people who have been through the system, that is a very strong incentive not to vote. If they may not vote because they may not know if they owe anything, and they may be afraid to get back into the system. Now, the other question that she asked was about recidivism and this impact on people's ability to move on with their lives. Three of the people that I spoke with, who are all clients of Operation New Hope, a local organization that helps people who have been through the system to get back on their feet, and they do some very great work here, and I believe they're in a few other places. They all expressed just absolute dismay at how much money they owed and kept saying, how is this going to keep me from going back into my old ways? I'm in a situation where I can't get good work because of my conviction, which is a totally another question that we could ask and talk about on a different day. But I want to be able to be a full participating member of society. And basically what the state is doing is giving me an incentive to go back to crime. And that's heartbreaking to hear. And also, what about the entire population? We're trying to do things that are good for all of the people. And I would argue that it's not good for all of the people if we're putting some of our fellow citizens in a situation where they have an incentive to go back to crime.
Lots of calls on this. Howard is in St. John's. Hey, Howard, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. My call is about the wording of the constitutional amendment. That amendment, that wording is now in the Constitution. Those are the words of the Constitution, and they take precedence over statutes. Now, a lot of the originalists argue the words of the Constitution mean what they say. Well, that's what these words say. They say that when they've finished their terms and met their terms of their conviction, that other than sex crimes and murder, that they should be able to vote. So the corollary of that, though, is with all these fines, then particularly if there's a fine of 15 cents for some juvenile thing, it should be easy then for the ex-felon to be able to learn what the amount of fees are. It sounds like that may not be so easy if people are unaware the amount of the fees.
Thanks, Howard. Thanks for that. Yeah, that's Howard in St. John's.
Yes, thank you, Howard. So there's a case that the ACLU is arguing, and the man, there are three different entities as to, you know, knowing how much you owe. There are three different entities in his jurisdiction, which is outside of our jurisdiction, that all have a recorded amount that he owes in restitution. All of those amounts are different. So he has no way of knowing which is the actual amount that he needs to pay. The issue is that there is no statewide system that tracks all of this. So each county is different. I would say that from what I've seen, I would say Duval County is among the better in terms of knowing how much you still owe. It's very easy to find it on the clerk of court website, but that may not be the case in other places. So we have no idea how much people owe cumulatively around the state and what those other jurisdictions are, you know, how they're tracking this, how well they're tracking this. And then it's putting the supervisors of elections in a position where they have to find data that's not in their system typically. But they may not even know which system it is in. I mean, it's just incredibly complicated, and it should be something simple to figure out whether or not you can vote. And to Howard's other point, his question was whether or not, because the terms of the amendment are part of the Constitution, does that trump the Senate bill? Well, it does not, because what the Senate essentially did is define the word sentence. When people think of sentence, I think many of us believe that that refers to the time you spend in jail or prison and possibly probation and parole. But what the legislature has done is define sentence to include payment of all these fees, fines, and restitution. And that's how they disenfranchised a million people.
John and Yuli. Go ahead, John. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. One of the things I don't understand is that the Senate did, in fact, in their bill, decide that they were going to define sentence to include fees. However, I don't understand why this fact has not been litigated and brought to the court. It seems to me that when one does this and includes fees and fines as part of the sentence, you basically, since it's just a money issue, you've done nothing more than reestablish an unconstitutional poll tax. We did away with poll taxes a long time ago, and there's no such thing as debtor's prison anymore. So I don't understand why this has not gone to court where people have challenged the correctness of this Senate interpretation.
Thank you, John. Oh, didn't mean to cut you off there, John. That's John and Yuli. Getting comments on our Facebook page, Claire, saying much the same. Here's one from a listener. A poll tax is a poll tax. The legislature openly and consciously cheated. Is this being litigated?
It is being litigated. There are several lawsuits, separate lawsuits. The Southern Poverty Law Center has filed one. The ACLU has filed another. And a lot of people are likening it to a poll tax. And quite frankly, it does very much resemble one. It was a different situation before they implemented Senate Bill 7066 because people could just vote. But now these people actually have to pay a fine or fee in order to get their voting rights. And what else is that but a poll tax?
Lots of emails and tweets. Meanwhile, here's one from Andrew. All of the financial obligations should be converted to community service, and people should be allowed to vote, he says. Tom emails the show. This is another example of the governor and state legislature disregarding the electorate. They did the same thing with conservation amendments, and yet they continue to get elected. Here is a message on Twitter from Tara. This is absolutely subverting the will of the voters, and it's politically motivated. The fines and fees system is utter arbitrary trash and differs in every jurisdiction. Finally, if payment of fines and fees is so critical to the voting process, why isn't it applicable to all, not just the formerly incarcerated, she says.
Right. Shouldn't, if you owe a debt to the court, should you be able to vote if someone else can't? I mean, you haven't paid your traffic ticket, now you can't vote. Does that actually make sense?
Here's another tweet. Lots of people weighing in on this and tying it to other controversies. It's not just the state government subverting the will of the people with the class size amendment, felon rights, and many other things, but it's our local government, too, with the school referendum and refusing to decriminalize small amounts of marijuana. Guess what they all have in common? This notion or this this perception among voters that whether it's at the local level or the state level, Claire, our elected representatives are not listening to the will of the voters on matters that have majority support. Like restoring felon voting rights, like keeping JEA publicly owned, like allowing the voters to decide on a sales tax referendum for Duval schools, et cetera.
That's exactly right.
And decriminalizing small amounts of marijuana.
Yet another one,
which
just the other
city
night.
Council voted down the other day. The majority of voters in this county support that.
Yes, they do. And this is a long-term trend that we've been seeing where people pass an amendment, like the land conservation amendment. That was a great example where it was overwhelmingly approved. And then it took them years to put any of the money they were supposed to be putting into land conservation. And you know, we keep voting for these people that don't listen to us when they get elected. And I realize that elected officials have tough questions to answer. But when you see this again and again and again, it's hard for a lot of people not to become disillusioned.
But let's give voice to the other side of this. Those who are concerned that people are not being incentivized to follow the law. Let's go to Mary in San Marco. Hi, Mary. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. What I'm concerned about, I understand the fines, there definitely needs to be some kind of change in the fines, but you're not talking very much about the third part of this, which is restitution. And I'm concerned that if a person commits a felony and there's a victim of this felony, that a person, I don't think, should be given back their rights to vote if they do not make restitution to the victim.
Thanks.
What do you think about that?
Thanks for that, Mary. What about that argument, Claire?
And that is definitely an argument that people probably would feel has the strongest, is the strongest argument for requiring people to pay something before they vote. But then would you require someone to pay off a civil judgment before they get their right to vote back? I mean, merely because it becomes a criminal proceeding, then a felony criminal proceeding, then they are going to have to pay restitution. But if you were sued for someone for civil battery, and just because it wasn't provable, you couldn't be convicted in a court of, you know, in a criminal court, you could have the same situation, but you do not lose your voting rights. I mean, what is logical?
Rick in Green Cove Springs. Hi, Rick. What say you?
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
My comment, am I on? I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, my comment would again be, just like your last caller, what's the incentive for not committing a crime? I mean, there's a lot of cost involved. I mean, if nobody would commit crimes, we wouldn't have to have police. If nobody would commit crimes, we wouldn't have to have courts. I mean, there's a whole lot of cost involved. I'm paying for that. I haven't committed a crime. I'm paying for all these services through my tax dollar. I don't particularly care for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. Okay. What about that argument from those who, you know, they don't have a problem with the system as it's in place. They see it as a deterrent.
Yeah, a deterrent, having these fees and fines. I would say that probably prison is the biggest deterrent. I mean, what is the value of your freedom? And these people, every single person of the four that I spoke with has been to jail or prison. One of the gentlemen I spoke with had been to prison for more than 20 years. That is a substantial portion of your life, and that is a stiff penalty. This man had drug charges. He was convicted under the habitual offender law. And then he gets out of prison and he owes thousands of dollars in probation fees. So, I mean, he's not going to be able to vote until he pays that off. Will he ever be able to vote? This man is, I mean, when people come out of prison, it is a very difficult transition.
when we hear the phrase, they paid their debt to society, traditionally we've interpreted that to mean they did time.
Right. We don't think they whipped out their checkbook and...
Yeah. So that's where the controversy lies. Meanwhile, the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, which got this Amendment 4 measure on the ballot to begin with and got it passed, they are now trying to help people pay their fines and fees if they can't afford to do it themselves. How's that working?
So they're raising funds for that, and it will only be available to people who have already paid off restitution and have made a good faith effort to better their lives. I know they're still working out the details, but you know, I spoke with Desmond Mead, who is the director there, I believe, and their position is that Amendment 4 provided a door to voting, and now we can have a separate conversation about fees and fines and their impact on Floridians, because even outside of the voting issue, this is a very serious problem, and to think of people such as the woman I spoke with who had a methamphetamine trafficking charge in 2004 and conviction. She owes $53,000. She's working part-time. She'll probably never be able to pay that off.
It's an outstanding piece of journalism that local journalist Claire Goforth has published nationally, looking at fines and fees preventing more than 1 million Floridians from voting despite the passage of Amendment 4 last year. Claire, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Much more still ahead. Up next, why more Americans are leaving the U.S. to try life abroad. Plus, a look at TEDx Jacksonville this year. But right now, here's how you can support WJCT.
By giving us a call at 353-9528 right now. We're almost at the $11,000 mark. We need your call for this, our flagship program here, 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross. A great program and serious subject matter most days. 353-9528 is the number you should call to support First Coast Connect, Fresh Air, All Things Considered, Morning Edition, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, The Electro Lounge, String Theory, all the great programs you listen to every week right here on 89.9. Needs your support now. We've had a great morning, but we can even do better if you will take the time to give us a call at 353-9528. We thank you so much for your support. We couldn't do it without you. Here's a little music to keep you going this morning while we wait to rejoin First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross. Please make that call now at 353-9528.
Thanks, David. Well, there's been a recent spike in the number of American citizens longing to leave the U.S. and live overseas. A new Gallup poll says 16% of Americans are now thinking about becoming expatriates. That's a record high. The reasons they give range from high medical costs here in the States, to our gun violence problem, to our extremely partisan political climate. Now, thinking about it is one thing. But one local couple went ahead and actually took the plunge. It's former Times Union columnist Philip Milano and his wife Robin, a teacher. Their mortgage is paid, and their kids are grown and flown. So they did some research, filled out a lot of paperwork, and just a week or so ago, they emigrated to a coastal town on the Mediterranean in Spain. They say they'll stay for at least a year, maybe more. I spoke with Philip Milano about their big move. Philip Milano, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Now, you and your wife are preparing to leave America and become expatriates, leaving the Jacksonville region for Spain, right?
That's right.
What prompted this decision?
Well, you know, on a personal level, I'm freelancing right now, and so I wasn't tied down to a full-time job. My wife is a teacher, and, you know, it's probably no secret to you that teaching can be a very stressful profession. And sometimes I think, particularly in professions like that, you need a break, you know, almost like a sabbatical. And we were talking about different ideas, and I had a friend from Canada who had lived in France, the south of France, for 6 months several years ago that I was really inspired by the fact that he had done that. And he had sent me an article about how you could do this. You know, you could go and live in another country. And so I kind of talked to Robin about that. And a couple days later, she said, I can't stop thinking about that. She said, I think you should investigate that. So I did. We looked at different places, Mexico, Costa Rica, even Uruguay. There were some concerns about violence, or at least the perception of safety in some of those countries. And so eventually we found out about Portugal and Spain, which are two of the more affordable, shall we say, countries that people have been migrating to from America and Great Britain and other places. So really it was kind of a toss-up between those two. Eventually decided on Spain and decided to go for it on a broader level. Violence and racism and guns and politics. It's just, I don't want to get negative, but I think maybe some of us are just a little fed up, and it's just, you know, we're kind of interested in seeing what it's like on the other side.
So a number of reasons then are driving your decision. It's interesting, though, to see this phenomenon in America. Whenever there's a difficult election, sometimes people will say, I'm going to leave the country if that person gets elected. And they don't really follow through with that. However, there has been a mini groundswell in the last couple of years of Americans actually following through and saying, I'm going to leave the country, and actually doing it, like you and your wife.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah. Well, I think that you're right. You're right on about that. You hit the nail on the head. And you also have to combine that with financial considerations and the economy. And again, I think that there are a lot of people, particularly in our age bracket, who just feel like the sort of the fairness issue with how people in our age bracket are treated by corporate America and by our employers, and the sense of there being a, you know, our parents, they, you know, often worked in the same job for decades, and they had no fear or concern about that, you know, their livelihood or how things were going to be when they retired. And we just don't have that anymore. And, you know, wages have flatlined for decades while the benefits decrease, while employers, you know, treat people with less and less respect in many ways. And so it gets to a point where you just start thinking, well, maybe I should see what else is out there. You know, this is the American dream we're living here, but it's not the only one. There might be a possibility for people to live a life a different way, and, you know, we're in a different culture. And I mean, I can't think of one person I've told this to who hasn't said, "Oh my God, I am so freaking envious of what you're doing. I have thought about this and wanted to do this, and you guys are doing it." For now, what we did is we went through a process called to obtain what's called a non-lucrative visa. And this is a visa that basically you're saying, hey, we have at least enough money where we're not going to be a burden on your social safety net system over there in Spain. When you get that non-lucrative visa, that allows you to go over to Spain and then apply for a long-term residency card, which is actually a little bit more simple process than the visa process. We had to go down to we had to make two trips to the Miami consulate, one with our stack of documents, and then once we got approved, then we had to go down there and physically pick up the visa.
Okay, so now that we have the full kind of understanding of all this, let me get your final thoughts. What advice would you have for people listening to how you came to this decision and they're considering doing the same thing?
Go for it. Don't let the somewhat challenge of the paperwork and the documents stop you from doing something like this. Life is short, folks. We can live our best life here in the States, but you can also see what it's like to live someplace else. You can have happiness in many different ways.
Well, Philip Milano, it's a pleasure, and I wish you the best of luck on your overseas adventure. Stay in touch.
We shall. Look for a blog or a Facebook post coming from me about everything, for sure.
Follow Philip Milano's Spain adventure with his wife on Facebook. We'll be right back.
First Coast Home Pros guarantees excellence in each of their professional home cleaning services, including carpet cleaning, grout cleaning, and more. More at FirstCoastHomePros.com. Our goal is to be the best service company you've ever invited to your home.
U.S. News and World Report names the University of Florida the nation's number 7 and the state's top public university in its 2020 Best Colleges ranking. Learn more at ufl.edu.
Welcome back. Well, TEDx Jacksonville is back on a local stage this fall, and this year's theme is pop. We're pleased to welcome Sabine Perways. She's executive producer, co-organizer of TEDx Jax, and Rowan Alcarbouche of the Mayo Clinic. She's a 2019 TEDx Jax speaker. Ladies, good morning.
Good morning.
Hello.
Good to see you, Sabine. So what can we expect from TEDx Jax this year? It seems every year it gets bigger and better.
Yeah, we're changing a few things up this year, and we are moving our Afterglow party to the Jesse Ball DuPont Center, and we'll have a variety of fun activities lined up for our speakers in addition to our amazing 11 speakers and performers. And some of those fun things include morning Tai Chi, an introvert room. We understand that everyone doesn't like sitting in those seats all day, so we're creating some comfort seating for them so they can go and move around Florida Theater.
Nice. Now, the theme is pop. What does that signify?
So we wanted to have fun this year. We didn't want everyone to feel like this is a heavy day. I'm going to hear talks that are going to make me feel overwhelmed and depressed. So we wanted to bring an element of fun. Pop means so many different things to people. It could mean their dad. It could mean popping the bubble. And that theme will be incorporated throughout the day in a variety of activities that the audience will witness.
So a really uplifting day. The speakers are always incredible. Rowan, you are a PhD candidate at Mayo Clinic, and you're going to be sharing some of your talk about the work you're doing around regenerative science and stem cell research, which is a really exciting field in medicine. What will we learn?
So there's so much to talk about when it comes to stem cell research. What are we dying of today, essentially? Chronic diseases, pure wear and tear. I mean, we don't live in a society of infection, kill, pill. Right now, we're trying to replace and restore something that has undergone permanent damage. So there's a shift in treatment paradigm. There's a shift in health and well-being and how to restore that. And so we're coming across mechanisms and technologies that may essentially help this process.
And are there negatives that you will touch on as well?
Absolutely. I think that's very important, especially in the talk that I'll be giving. It's important to engage two ends of the spectrum. I mean, that you hear about stem cell research, but what is it exactly? How are you engineering these stem cells? What are we willing to do, and how far are we willing to push the boundaries? I mean, the potential is actually remarkable, but also it comes with unprecedented risks. And that's kind of what we'll be talking about. Especially, it's important to engage the public because everyone's a stakeholder. And this is going to affect you and the next generation and even your mother and your father, your grandparents. And it's a way to just engage in dialogue and see. And I think as scientists, our purpose is to make new discoveries and provide tools, but not necessarily to discuss and to make decisions on ethical and moral dilemmas. At this point, it's very important for the public now to engage.
Stem cell research does divide people along ethical lines. The using of stem cells, which some who feel that it's morally wrong have really vigorously opposed. What about that?
So it's important to understand where these stem cells are coming from. What are the sources? Now, they're federally regulated, at least embryonic stem cells. These are they're taken from in vitro clinics that have been fertilized but would have been discarded. The potential of embryonic stem cells, these are stem cells that when you think of stem cells, they're the raw material of your body. They're the ones that are unspecialized and are capable of specializing into brain, muscle, nerve, and so forth. The argument with that is how are we using this technology to better understand health and disease? You have boundaries now that are pushed. You think of things from, you know, before in Hollywood, you think of designer babies, cloning. Mm-hmm. Now we're coming across these issues. And that's something very important to discuss. There is a lot of controversy, but there's a lot of potential as well.
So this is just one example, Sabine, of the kind of fascinating expertise we will hear at TEDx Jacksonville. Who are some of the other speakers that you're excited about?
There's so many amazing topics that we're covering this year. We always try to ensure that the topics are relevant, cutting edge, innovative, and allowing our audience to think about new perspectives on issues that are already grappling with. One speaker that I'm personally really excited to hear is Tammy Hodo, only because race is something we're talking about so much as a society right now. And Tammy shares her personal lived experience around being a biracial woman and just the evolution of what it has meant to be African-American from a very fact-based perspective using census forms and how they've evolved over decades as the census is coming up next year. So it's always fascinating to bring fact and lived experience to an issue that people are very, very polarized on.
It's gotten to the point where TED is so ubiquitous now in our culture that whenever anybody posts anything online that they feel strongly about, they'll say, and thank you for coming to my TED Talk. So how do you see TED evolving that way? It's really become a big part of our cultural and political discourse.
So one thing that we've tried this year, we actually had our last one a week ago, is an idea club, exactly to your point. Sometimes people want to have a safe space to discuss issues that they're grappling with and create a sense of community locally. So we had these small groups, less than 25 people, around heavily contentious topics in our community, from mental health, elections, education, and giving them the space to meet Jacksonvillians from around different neighborhoods and coming together and talk. So we as an organization are always looking at how can we further the idea of TED, ideas worth spreading, and our mission to have informed Jacksonville residents.
In the meantime, go to TEDxJacksonville.com and get your tickets now for TEDx Jax 2019. It's coming up Saturday, October 19th at the Florida Theater. This year's theme is pop, and you'll get admission to the after party and a lot of fun, too. So thank you, Sabine Perwes of TEDx Jax, and Speaker Rowan Al-Karbush of the Mayo Clinic. Going to be a great event. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
In a moment, cuffin season is upon us. Are you looking to couple up this fall? We'll have some advice for singles next.
I'm Courtney Lewis, music director of the Jacksonville Symphony. We're opening our season with Fanfare, featuring the uniquely creative jazz pianist Marcus Roberts and his trio performing Gershwin's iconic Rhapsody in Blue. The Chicago Tribune said of Roberts' Rhapsody, "Considering the caliber of his pianism and the originality of his ideas, it's easy to believe that Gershwin himself would have savored this work." Join us on September 28th. Tickets and more, jacksymphony.org.
On the next Fresh Air, As the formal impeachment inquiry poses the greatest threat yet to the Trump presidency, we look at the life and career of Vice President Pence. Veteran political reporter Tom LoBianco has covered Pence for decades. He's just written a new book called Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House. Join us. Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Robin Young. Ohio's been called ground zero for the opioid crisis. Rural Minford has started some programs to help the littlest kids. In one elementary school, every single kid has been touched by the opioid overdose epidemic.
You know, if we don't give everything that we can give to this, you look at the numbers and it's almost like wiping out a whole generation.
Next time, here and now.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.9 WJCT.
As lawmakers bicker over climate change, most economists agree that the best, cheapest way to reduce carbon emissions is to tax them. Scores of countries and some states have introduced some form of carbon pricing. How does it work? And how well does it work? Making polluters pay. Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, cuffing season is almost upon us, that time of year when the weather turns and singles look to cuddle up with a new romantic interest. So we've invited Jacksonville matchmaker Renee Stilberg to join us with a little advice for singles hoping to find their true match. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so from Urban Dictionary, cuffing means to be cuffed or tied down by a relationship. And people always say they start to feel this urge more when the weather cools off. So it's good timing to have you in today. People want to cozy up in front of the fire with a new romantic interest.
Sure. Absolutely. You know? This is the time that, you know, go ahead.
Yeah, this is the time to do it. So your company, True Match, you just wrapped up a really successful dream date contest, and that celebrated National Matchmaker Day. And so how did that work out?
It was wonderful. They had such a great time, and it's always fun to, I say, spread love in the city. We were celebrating, honoring all the other matchmakers out there in the industry that are worldwide that we collaborate and work together to find some of the best clients and matches out there.
And fall will be your busy season, right? How does it work? How does your company pair people up? How does this work?
Yeah, so we start off with working directly with our client, and then, you know, we do background checks and extensive interviews and meet with people in person to make sure that we're finding them a compatible partner in every area of their life for not only today, but a future love and what that looks like. So we do a lot of assessments and questionnaires and things like that that really help us to get to know our client.
And this is the time of year when people want a date to go to tailgating and holiday parties. The social calendar gets really busy after Labor Day. So now's the time, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And I always say, you know, this is the time to really accept those invitations. Put yourself out there, you know, dress your best, smell your best. It's amazing, the smallest little details. And, you know, approach someone. I think today so many people are fearful of going up to someone, but us women are definitely ones to go after what we want. So do the same. And men, too, you know, give someone a compliment. Start off a conversation that way.
Now, what would you say to those who really are looking for love, but they're hesitant to use a service like yours or even go on a national website where they can try to find people to go out with?
Right. So I always tell everybody, you know, we are the way that is private and confidential, and your information is not out there public for everyone to see. And, you know, you can either become a client and go on our website and fill out, you know, a questionnaire or even call us and we'll meet with you in person to find you that compatible match. And if you want to be somebody that's considered for us to call for one of our clients, then you can do the same thing. So it's all, you know, we do background checks, like I said, and really handhold everyone through the experience so you don't get lost in the sea of online dating.
Yeah, that can be a little overwhelming.
It is, and it's scary and time consuming and expensive and all those other details.
Now, is this true? You actually do follow-up interviews after people go on dates?
We do. And that's where I say it's always that critical moment of really the transformation in a client of finding them someone they may have never considered dating, that some of my most happiest, successful clients today really met through being open-minded and present and considering somebody that they've never would have met before.
That can be hard because people have an idea in their head of their one true match.
Yeah.
But it may not be the right one.
Exactly. Exactly. And there's so many times, I mean, one tip I always kind of give everybody is I feel like I hear it in the feedback constantly is if you're interested, pursue that person with a simple, I'm thinking of you text or, you know, something to let someone know that you're really interested.
Any other tips for people looking for love out there this cuffin season?
Absolutely. Like I said, you know, put yourself out there. We don't know you exist. So go on our website. We've got a great blog to give more information on dating tips and the difference of a matchmaker versus other ways of finding love out there on your own. And go to our website at onetruematch.com that will give you more information of how we can then hopefully meet you and find you that love you're looking for this fall.
And that's the number one, truematch.com. She's Jacksonville's own modern day matchmaker, Renee Stilberg. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
All right, that's our show. Thanks for listening. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Quorum directs the show. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. On tomorrow's show, it's our Friday Roundtable. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And right now, here's how you can support WJCT this fall.
All you have to do is just call us at 904-353-9528 or 1-800-722-9528 after you're done calling One True Match, of course. This is the WJCT Pledge Drive. We're trying to get to $80,000. We're almost at 11, and we're almost at 10 a.m. Give us a call, 353-9528. You know, the station here at WJCT, we've been on the air since 1972. That's 47 years of giving you the very best in local independent programming, news, sports, arts and leisure, everything you need. We need your support. We need your help. Like you've always been here for us. We're here for you. Give us a call, 904-353-9528. I'm Sheldon Hall. I'm here from Folio Weekly and all kinds of other things, sitting in, helping out with the Pledge Drive. They've been very kind to let me come in and help them out. If you donate, everyone who donates today and every day gets entered in a drawing to win a free Amazon Echo. And you may have noticed in the news yesterday, Amazon came forth with all kinds of nice little goodies and gimmicks, a bunch of little peripherals that can be attached to your Amazon Echo. And soon you will be able to get Alexa's voice replaced with that of Samuel L. Jackson. And a lot of people have been asking me, so you need to know you can get the explicit or the non-explicit version, only 99 cents. Call us now.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.